Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2008 Home Education Conference held in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
This is a wonderful subject to be able to teach. Problem is, I've got a year's worth of curriculum to try and condense down in an hour. So obviously, there's no way in the world I can do real justice to the Native Americans, but I will share with you some of the very tidbit highlights and the tip of the iceberg stuff about Native American history. Because when I was doing my history research, I fell in love with the people, all of them. And even though they have some very unique beliefs and ways of life, you can see some gospel strands going through, more so in some and less in others. But anyway, we need to understand that the Native Americans over here in North, Central, and South America, I'll be covering all three areas, are of a mixed origin and blood. I think it's going to be a little bit hard for this DNA stuff when they try and focus on one particular aspect of society, because they're going to all be blended from various groups and organizations. And that should come to light to you here in the first few minutes of my presentation. According to the Book of Mormon, we've got three of the tribes of the House of Israel represented over here. Lehi was from the tribe of Manasseh, Ishmael was from the tribe of Ephraim, and Mulek was from the tribe of Judah. Now, all three are descendants from Abraham, so that might focus your attention on one particular aspect of culture and society. However, archaeologists have come up with various other organizations and groups that have been here from various digs that have been done. And I want to share with you some of that information here. Yes? Lehi came from the tribe of Manasseh, Ishmael's from Ephraim, and Mulek came from Judah. Now, of course, you've also got the Jaredites, but according to understanding, most of them were all destroyed. But that would be even before Abraham's time. One of the problems that we have with the Native Americans is they didn't record anything. Or what very little we haven't either been able to interpret and translate what they are, or they're very fragmented and don't give a complete history at all of what the people were like. So most of what our information that we've been able to gather comes from archaeological digs and man's interpretation of the writings on the walls and reading what's found in the ground and so forth. The Book of Mormon does give us some information, however, it doesn't tell us who it's talking about specifically. And I think the Lord arranged that in one particular way so that we would focus on the message of the Book of Mormon as a witness of Christ and not get hung up on the geography or the archaeology, or what particular group of people that the Book of Mormon's talking about. And there's all kinds of different conjectures as to who they cover. I'm not covering any of that kind of stuff, nor do I address it in my book. There is one comment that's made by the Lord in the Book of Mormon regarding this land. And he says, "And behold, it is wisdom that this land should be kept as yet from the knowledge of other nations. For behold, many nations would overrun the land, that there would be no place for an inheritance." Now, it is interesting when I share with you all the various groups that we have evidence that came over here, none of their knowledge ever got transferred over to the new old world until the Lord saw fit that it was time to let the world understand that there was an entire world over here that we call the new world. And so how the Lord managed to do it was just kind of like he just drew a blanket over everybody, and they weren't interested in pursuing and colonizing Americas or nothing. So first of all, we've got an overhead here. This is just of the United States. And this is just a smattering of some of the various tribes that have been located and that existed around here in the United States. I grew up in Colorado, and Arapahoe was the county in which I was living in for many years as a young man. Many of our cities and towns, rivers, mountains, obtained their names from the Native Americans. I get a kick out of the Kickapoo. That's a pretty cool name. Those ladies, I like a Choctaw, sounds tough. And a Chickasaw sounds tough. Anyway, we've all got our various favorite tribes and all that in history. I have a particular love, and I will wrap up my presentation on this, in regards to the Nez Perce from what I know about those people. And I'll share that with you at the end. Anyhow, the Japanese, we have evidence that the Japanese came over. In 1956, it was found in Ecuador, a series of figurines that had a distinctive oriental design and artwork of long barrel mustaches. There are nobles that are being carried around on a litter with an oriental type umbrella, and various other insignia and signs and images on this pottery and vessels that are of a Japanese nature. We have what's called the Tennessee Kibbutz, where in the Tennessee River Valley, an area called Bat Creek, I don't know if anybody knows any of that stuff, it's called the Tennessee Nine, where a burial plot was found of nine individuals who are considered to be of Jewish refugees coming out from Palestine during the rebellion of Simon Bar Kokhba. Anybody who knows about Jewish history, Simon Bar Kokhba was a proclaimed Messiah who between 132 and 135 AD tried to free the Jewish people from Roman rule. The brass bracelets found on the bodies of the Tennessee Nine were only made in the Roman area between 40 BC and 200 AD. We have evidence of the Chinese, a gentleman by the name of Weishan, who in the 18th century, so that'd be in the 1700s, we have Chinese documents documenting him and several other monks coming over to the crossing the Great Eastern Sea, as they called it, and came to a land that they called Fusong. And the description of Fusong matches the description of Mexico. And he also then travels northward and comes to the northwestern part of the United States and describes a group of Native Americans who had no appreciation whatsoever of gold and silver and who never carried on warfare. And that is descriptive of your Northeast Indians, the Yakima and the Modocs, and those were never really interested in carrying on warfare, and there is no gold and silver up at that particular place of any significance at all. We've got the Irish, evidence that the Irish came over. An Irish monk by the name of Brendan wrote, or he was written of in a novel that was published in between the 5th and the 6th centuries entitled The Voyage of St. Brendan the Abbot. Came over here with a bunch of his companions, and according to his descriptions, landed in the Caribbean or the Florida coast. Then they traveled north for about 40 days, and based on the direction they went, they would have come to either the Mississippi or the Ohio rivers. And legend in the book that Brendan had written states that he was met by a messenger from God who told him not to go any further inland. Instead, the land was promised to future generations as a place of refuge during troubled times. We have evidence that the Welsh came over. A gentleman by the name of Prince Madoc came over here in 1170. The book was published of his travels in 1583, talking about him and 120 other men coming to the area of Florida. They then went back home, brought a bunch more settlers to come over here, and then their history is lost. According to early American explorers, they believed that these Welsh Indians became the Mandan Indians that we have. They're not on the map, but they would be in the Dakotas and Minnesota area. And they were the ones who helped Lewis and Clark on their expedition. The Mandan speaks a derivative of the Welsh language. And they are fair-skinned with gray and blue eyes, where the Native Americans have more black eyes and dark brown eyes. And George Catlin, who is an American artist, drew these people has much more fair skin. And so we believe that Madoc, when he came over, his people ended up intermarrying with the Native Americans, traveled to the north central part of what is now the United States, and became known as the Mandan Indians. The last group that I want to mention is a Jewish connection in South America. There was a Spanish gentleman who had a Jewish guide that he met over here to give him a tour of some of the ruins and various places over here. And he was greeted with the distinctive Jewish term, Shema Israel, which means, "Hear, O Israel." So it's interesting that we have the Jewish language, Hebrew language, brought over here that they were greeted when they came over as various explorers in these particular parts. And this was down in the Ecuador area. Archaeologists have found over time, depending on the groups that they are talking to and excavating and learning about, various Old Testament customs of ritual calendars, purification rites, circumcision, myths of the flood, sacrifices to gods, and the story of a tribal ark. Now, I don't discount any of these ideas and suggestions on how the Native Americans came here. The Prophet Joseph Smith, nor the Book of Mormon, ever makes claim that that is the sole source of how the Native Americans got here. I believe it is one of the sources of how they got here. I don't discount the Bering Strait idea, but I certainly discount that being the only way in which the Native Americans got over here. We have to bear in mind that mankind as a whole has rejected the Book of Mormon, and so they cannot accept the Book of Mormon's explanation at all of how the Native Americans got here, and so they have to come up with some other explanation. I think the Lord used various means to bring people over here. So we can't get hung up on trying to identify this is where they came from and this is where they are. But with the Book of Mormon, we appreciate the message and the testimony that's there, and then let the Lord work out the details when He sees fit. But we take from all of these sources to learn about the Native Americans. There is an interesting comment that is made in the early days of the church during the time that the Prophet Joseph Smith was here, in which various learned individuals in church history try to identify where Lehi and Nephi landed. Problem is, we still have conflict with those sources, and so it still doesn't answer the question. But just a little tidbit here. This was in a book called The Compendium by a couple of individuals. It was published in 1882, and that would be before Joseph Smith's, or after Joseph Smith's time. Published later on in the Deseret News in 1912. But anyway, the authors of their sources say, they traveled nearly a south-southeast direction until they came to the 19th degree of north latitude, then nearly east to the Sea of Arabia, then sailed in a north-southeast direction and landed on the continent of South America in Chile, 30 degrees south latitude. Orson Pratt had the same belief that they landed about 30 degrees south latitude in his book that he published in 1840 called Remarkable Visions. Joseph Smith never made comment. Then the Times and Seasons, which was the church's publication in 1842, so still Joseph Smith's time, it stated in there, Lehi went down by the Red Sea to the Great Southern Ocean, crossed over to this land, and landed a little south of the Isthmus of Darien, which would be Panama, long way away, and improved the country. So that would land them somewhere around Colombia or Ecuador. So even that information doesn't help us solve the mystery. Where do they all come from, and how did they, and where did they land? What is interesting is they were here. So I would like to share with you just some of the tidbits that I've learned from these various cultures and tribes so that you can gain an appreciation for the diversity of the Native American culture. And I want to start with the Eskimos. Obviously, I don't have enough time to go into detail on a lot of this stuff, but just want to share with you. Eskimo means raw meat eaters. And if you think about the culture, they're up there in ice-bound land. They don't have any trees, and so they had no ability to be able to cook their food, and so they had to live off of raw meat. They had no tribes and no chiefs. All they had were a set of moral laws by which culture and society lived. And when you had somebody who violated a law, either there was a fist fight between the two offending parties, or a contest of insults. The one that's used the most was the insults. And they would sing insults to the other person. And whoever broke down first and got upset lost the contest. And that's how they resolved their problems when it came amongst the Eskimos, which I thought was an interesting way in which to carry on things in their particular society. Their most important god was a female goddess by the name of Sedna. She was the god of the sea. And obviously, most of their meat and things came from the walrus and the seal and the whales and shark, all that kind of stuff. And so it was very important to satisfy her, to make her happy. And so as they would kill these various animals, they would save the bladders. And each year, they would have a very sacred bladder ceremony in which they would then bless all of the bladders that they had collected for the past year and then dump it into the sea as an offering to Sedna, that she would then provide them with the meat that they would need to carry on for the next year. Hunting became a very unique thing for these people to be able to do. Hunting walruses and seals was their main source of food. And what the hunters would do is that they would find the various air holes that were in the ice and stake out an air hole and try and lure the seal or the walrus or whatever to that particular air hole by scratching the ice. And so they would usually scratch the ice with their harpoon that they would have and scratch the ice. But they would have to remain perfectly still so that the walrus or the seal wasn't spooked off by this, you know, human standing there. And would have to stand perfectly still for hours or days until finally they would see the seal or the walrus come up for air and instantly throw the harpoon at it. Now, I don't know how many of you get stiff when you're sitting. You know, you'll be here for an hour in class and you try and get up, your knees are stiff or whatever, your back, you need to stretch it out. Can you imagine holding perfectly still for hours on end, days on end, freezing to death, waiting for some seal to finally surface, and then you've got to take a harpoon and you've got one shot, and if you miss, everything that you did was for naught. They were extremely good hunters. Otherwise, they went hungry. Interesting stuff about them. What I want to talk about, let's come down south. We're going to talk about the mound builders. These guys are fascinating. There were three different cultures of mound builders over the course of the centuries. The oldest group of mound builders are called the Adena, between 700 BC and 400 AD. And they built burial mounds. This particular mound is called the Grave Creek Mound, and it's located in Moundsville, West Virginia. This thing is 70 feet high, and they can excavate these hills, and they are burial tombs inside. Some were not burial tombs, but were actually temples, or there would have been a temple placed on top, and they would hold their worship services on top of the mound, and there would be a temple on top of that. One of the most fascinating ones of the Adena that I think would be cool, and one day I would love to get to Ohio to see this, it's now a city park. It's called the Serpent's Mound. This is the tail of the serpent, and it winds around all through here, and you finally end up over here to the mouth, and it looks like it's eating an egg. This mound is a quarter of a mile long, 5 feet high, 20 feet wide, and what they did was they constructed this mound as they buried the dead in it and created this. Now, the reason why it's in the shape of a serpent was that was one of their gods. And what better way to return back to God than to have your body buried in the body of your God? And they didn't only have animals, they also had shapes, various circles and octagons and various other shapes. They had eagles, bears, all various other kinds of animals that they did. But anyway, this is probably considered one of the most famous ones, is the Great Serpent's Mound.
Have they excavated the whole thing?
No, they've excavated enough to determine that it was a burial mound. And then kept it sacred, made a park, and so that we don't. And there's just a little path. This is a pathway around it that you can go around and view the park, view the mound. Yeah. In Ohio, this is in Newark, Ohio. And it's part of what they call the Newark Earthworks. No, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong one here. Serpent's Mound is in Hillsboro, Ohio. Now let's get to the Newark Earthworks. This is from the next group that kind of took over. They're called the Hopewell. This one is not a burial mound that we know of. But what they did was they built these mounds. There's one that's there. There's one that's here. And these mounds block off a whole large section. It's believed that the center was a sacred center plaza in which they carried on sacred dances and services to worship their gods. And then you've got another set of mounds that go around and surround this. And so it's kind of an earthwork, a whole big area of mounds. Problem is, these people didn't write anything, and so our knowledge of them is very limited as we try and use our knowledge today to get back to what they were like then and figure out what in the world these people were doing. But anyway, I just think it's fascinating. Thomas Jefferson had one on his property, Monticello. And he'd love to do a little bit of digging around and excavating on that, and there's some burial mounds that have been found in his mound. The last group was the Mississippians. These particular people existed when the Spanish got here. Not just Mississippi was probably the largest group of these Native Americans who were here, but Monk's Mound is in Cahokia, Illinois, and it's the largest one. This thing has a base larger than the Great Pyramid in Egypt, and it's built by hand. Of course, so was the Great Pyramid in Egypt, but they'd bring in their buckets full of dirt, and it's believed that there was then a temple on top of this flat top over here. And of course, you can see the steps that went up to the top. That's why they believe there was that. They estimate there's at least 10,000 mounds in the Ohio-Tennessee valleys. We go all the way from Canada and New York, even on down to Florida, all the way over into Mississippi, just all over the place that these three different cultures, the mound builders, as we call them, carried on their existence. As they've excavated these mounds, the most common piece of evidence that they have found is a pipe. Now, you and I have our own particular visions of a pipe. Okay, just the little stubby thing with the little place where they put their tobacco. These mound builders, we have found, had 27 different varieties of tobacco and other leaves that they smoked from these pipes. And I just took one sample of that I could blow up here for a picture to give you an idea of the intricacy of these pipes. This is called the Great Duck Pipe. Here's the duck's head, neck, and body. This is where they would put the tobacco, and then they would smoke it. And the pipe was always buried with the men, whatever their most sacred item was. You and I, when we see the little Western shows on TV, you know, we're smoking the peace pipe and all that. No, their pipes were part of their worship. It was either their animals that were worshipped or the animal gave them their life. And so they would make these things into the and very intricate and bury these with the persons. And there's just a flood of pipes, various shapes. I mean, you got lions, tigers, bears, whatever, all that kind of stuff. But anyhow, I just think that was fascinating with the pipe. Now, I don't want to stick around on one subject too long. Let's go to the Maya. The Maya is probably the first most advanced culture and civilization that we have found over here. The others would be the Inca and the Aztecs. The Maya had religious ceremonies that affected every day of their life. There's the secular calendar and the religious calendar. And it's like two cogs in a wheel that would mesh together. And every 52 years, they would come to the same day, and then they would rotate around. One was worshiping the secular things. The other was worshiping the spiritual things or the deities. And, of course, every 52 years when it came, that became an extremely sacred day. There's over 160 different gods that have been identified so far from the translations of the Mayan language that they've been able to figure out. That's a lot of gods. Okay. One of the most fascinating things about these people is their worship, a little bit gory, sorry to say. One of the favorite things that they like to do, and it's especially for the emperor to do, was to cut his body in some of the most tender places, spread the blood on bark paper, and then offer that bark paper as a sacrifice of his life-giving blood to the gods. And that was feeding the gods the blood of the king. Also, the smoke from that was a prayer being sent up to the gods. But it was a tremendously important ceremony that we have evidences drawn from various illustrations that were done of the emperor sacrificing his blood on bark paper and then burning it in front of the people. Yeah, who'd want to become king when that kind of thing happened? All over Mexico, you find these ball courts. Now, I'm going to imagine, you got to follow me along here. This is the main part of the playing field. It's kind of like a capital I. So we got one end of the I right here, another end of the I here. Then this is bleachers cut into the stone, and you got bleachers over here. This is actually a shadow that you can't see. So you got the bleachers, okay? And you got the players down here on the playing field. And the whole idea of the two teams was to get a hard rubber ball through this hole of this stone thing that was attached to the side 20 feet up above the ground. And they could not touch the ball by their hands. And so the images of the players, they are heavily padded, knee pads and shoulder pads and elbow pads and all that, as they would try and get the ball through here. Whoever won, either by individual, because you could also have individual games, or by team, got to sacrifice and kill the losers. And the whole game was part of worshiping the gods. And it was considered an honor to actually lose and be sacrificed to the gods. They would also throw people into wells. We have waterfalls and stuff. And they would toss humans into there, and they found bones down in the bottom that they would sacrifice, especially young people. Or when there was a new king being anointed, offering sacrifices, human sacrifices to the gods. But this ball game is a very bloody, violent game. Also, they have evidence based on interpretation of drawings that if it was an individual who lost, that they would bind the individual up as tightly as possible and bounce the person around until the person passed away. And they would even haul them up to the top of the pyramid and bounce them down the steps. A bloody group of people, okay? But they weren't all that bad. I mean, we can't be too hard on them, okay? One of the most famous traditions amongst the Native Americans, especially amongst the Maya, is the tradition of the great white god Quetzalcoatl. Now, Quetzalcoatl is identified either with the Aztecs and various other cultures under the various names. We know him as Quetzalcoatl, Kukulcan, the plumed serpent, the healer, the prophet, the lord of the wind and water, and the mighty. And when Cortez came over and met with the Aztecs, Cortez landed the same day of the traditional belief of the Aztecs of the return of the great white god. So when Cortez got here and Montezuma meets him, they worship Cortez because of the belief that the great white god had returned. It's interesting when I speak to non-LDS audiences that, I can't mention the LDS stuff, but I certainly point out some of the things, and so those that might be in the audience that are LDS can pick up on it. But I want to share with you only one of the traditions, the legends about the great white god. And what is interesting is this author, it's entitled He Walked the Americas. The author is L. Taylor Hansen, and he's non-LDS. He was at the University of Minnesota doing studies on the Native Americans and met with various Native Americans, with various powwows, and they would share with him their legends, and he wrote the legends in this book. And here's one of them. Now you tell me who they're talking about. The legend of Cabba Close. The city of Cabba Close first saw the pale god when he stopped the tempest and gelled the sea for his ship's landing, then easily walked across the waters. Well, doesn't that sound familiar, huh? They remembered his strange magnetism before them, for before him the fiercest animals lay down and allowed him to caress them. For his one god, the divine spirit, they built a temple. Then he left them to teach other nations, promising to return to dedicate the temple. Alas for man and his jealous priesthood. The priests were again in power when once more the pale god returned. The priests had busily told the people that this was a demon who had bewitched them. Accordingly, when the pale god returned along the highway, his long white mantle and his great staff, keeping his promise to the people to dedicate his temple, warriors lay in wait behind the bushes, their arrows already strung on in their longbows. The puzzled people, led by the black-robed priest, came forward. Then at a signal from the head priest, the warriors sprang out of the foliage and a rain of arrows went toward the prophet. Standing atop a slight mound, the pale god raised his palms high over his head and called aloud in a foreign language. Then a curious miracle happened. A curtain of flame, fiercely whirling, came down upon him from the heavens, clear up to now with the bright sun shining. This curtain circled about the healer. The arrows of the warriors could not penetrate the curtain. They glanced off as if from hard rock and struck again through the bows which had sent them, burying their shafts deep into the breasts of the senders. When the people saw this, they were stricken with terror, and the wicked priests fell down sobbing. In the center of the curtain, the pale god stood waiting, and when it lifted, he turned his back upon them and walked away sadly along the shore. His footsteps were pressed deeply in the wet sand, where none have ever been able to erase them. Even today, along the Cabba Close River, one can still see the steps of the fair god as he walked away from the wicked city. And this book is full of those legends. Just to think that the Lord was over here, and we have other evidence besides the Book of Mormon that tells us of the Lord being here. Now, get out your papers that I passed out here at the beginning. I'm going to teach you a little Mayan math. Now, once you learn this, obviously I'm not going to have much time to be able to do it. Time's running away already. One of the most difficult things archaeologists had to figure out was all of the Mayans' writings are the little square things, and there's an image in there. And it's trying to figure out what the image means and then tie it into the next image to understand what the message has to say. Okay. They finally broke the code, realizing that the Mayans counted by 20s and not by 10s, which throws us off. Okay, have you ever tried to count by 20s? And try and teach this to your kids. I have fun teaching this with my kids when I'm teaching in the private school I used to teach in for 10 years. Is teaching them Mayan math and helping them learn how to add and subtract and figure out their numbers. So, with your piece of paper, find this page. I don't know which page it got stapled on there. But here's what you got to follow along now. I'm not going to be able to spend much time. The Mayan created this shell-shaped figure for zero. There's only two other cultures that ever have done that. Now, for the life of me, it escapes me who they are. The Babylonians? And anyway. So this is zero. One dot represents one. Everything that's going to be on this first line is going to be multiplied by one. Okay? Four dots, four. A dash is five. Two dashes and one dot, that's going to be an 11. This would be 19. Now, here comes the tricky part. A shell for zero, but a dot on the next level. Next level is going to be multiplied by 20. So 20 times 1 is 20, 0. There's the number 20. You got 2, 0, and there's your number 20. Here is, you've got 6 times 20 would be 120 plus 6, 126. And then you can go on, you can multiply it with other numbers, and I carried this on a little bit further for you. Okay? All right. Now, with that in mind, so keep one finger on that page. Now, what is fun to do is I would give the kids, after I taught them that, I would give them this, and this is a number. What's the number? 65. And you'll see that on the next page where I've got the 65. And so for fun, you can create your own Mayan numbers and then have your children figure out what the numbers represent. Or you can create your own numbers and then have your children write the Mayan answer to it. Now, this answer is not to that. I put them on separate pages so that they can't cheat. And you can create however big long numbers you want to. Just remember, you got to go to the different levels and multiply by the different numbers to come up with these. Anyway, it took them for the longest time to figure out Mayan numbers because of the 20. And we don't think that way. And then trying to figure out not only 20, but how this multiplication stuff works. Okay? Anyway, you can have all kinds of fun with Mayan math, but I'm sorry, I don't have enough time to continue on much more than that. But I did want to share that with you. Couple other interesting groups that I want to mention. The Iroquois, northeastern part of the United States. They had a unique way in which to determine the courage of a captive soldier, warrior. And the belief was that if this particular person was courageous enough, they could then obtain the courage from that person through death. And so what they would do would torture the captive, especially by cutting off fingers and toes. And if a captive could sing his death song, and all the Native Americans, most of the Native Americans, had their own death song, they would start singing their death song knowing that they were going to die. If this person could sing their death song and not cry out while they were losing fingers and toes, the Native Americans, especially the Iroquois, would want to obtain the courage of that man, so they would take his heart out and eat it. Yuck. Now, you ladies didn't escape this either. They didn't go through death for them. But for a lady, her courage was based on childbirth. The woman knelt on a deer skin and held on to a pole as the baby was born. If she cried or made any kind of noise during labor, she was scolded for not being brave. Okay. The Iroquois were a very unique group of people who used everything that they could from nature to take care of their needs. Now, yesterday, those of you who were in my class, and I had mentioned about Father Sky and Mother Earth. I'm now going to tap back into that terminology that I mentioned yesterday. I told you you'd have to come today to get the punchline on it, okay? So here it starts. You'll be able to understand now when they look at Father Sky and Mother Earth, because, and this is how the Native Americans, in this case the Iroquois, the juice from green stalks was applied to cuts and bruises. Dry stalks were hollowed out and plugged and used to store medicines. Rough cobs made good scrub brushes and stoppers for jugs, and dried kernels were used as beads and rattles. Women shredded corn husks to make filling for pillows and mattresses, or wove husks into trays, baskets, mats, and slippers. Mothers made corn husk dolls with corn silk hair for their daughters, and men fashioned ceremonial masks from the dried leaves. They boiled water by dropping hot stones from the fire directly into clay pots. Women used gourd ladles to scoop food out of the cooking pots. People ate with wooden spoons and bowls and drank from cups made from turtle shells or carved from wood. Who provided these for them? Mother Earth and Father Sky. Everything that the Native Americans had, they received from Mother Earth and Father Sky. And so when the white man came and wanted to pay the Native Americans to buy this piece of land so that they could then fence it off and call it theirs. There was no concept at all in the mind of the Native Americans how you could do that, because Father Sky was everywhere, Mother Earth was everywhere, and they provided life. How can you buy part of Mother Earth? Or how can you say, this is my part of the sky, or whatever. Yet with the white man's thinking coming from England and Europe and the feudal system, and you can own this and buy that and trade this and trade that, there was a complete conflict. The white man did not learn to respect the Native Americans' way of life, and the Native Americans could not comprehend life any other way. And so naturally you had conflict. And neither side could come to a resolution to it. But I just find it fascinating when you read that, how they did everything in that way. Here's another example. When you had a warrior go hunting, when he killed the animal, he knelt beside it and offered a prayer of thanks for its providing food and clothing for his family. Before he skinned the deer, he prayed that its spirit would be reborn and have a better life. Even in death, they had prayers over their animals and hoped that the spirit would be reborn into something else. So even the animals gave them food and raiment. Here comes the white man. Oh, let's go out and have a hunting party. Shoot whatever they could, take whatever part they want, and left it there. Where the Native American used every part of the animal that they could because it provided its life. And the hunter had prayed over first he prays that he will be provided with the food that he needs, that Father Earth and Mother Earth and Father Sky will provide this food. And once he gets the food, then he prays over the animal that gave its life, thank you very much. What respect does the white man show? None at all. Complete opposites of culture. The cliff dwellers. I don't know how you've been to Mesa Verde. I've been there. That is cool out there. Seeing all the pueblos and the cliff dwellings and all that kind of stuff. This is a picture of a kiva. And the kiva to the cliff dwellers and the pueblos, the cliff dwellers, remember, they lived in the cliffs. They were also related to the pueblos who built their cities and all that. But they all had similar kind of things, which was a sacred place underground called a kiva. And in the kiva was where all the worshiping was done, to connect between the living and the dead. This here is a fireplace. This rock wall was to prevent the wind that was coming in from the bottom or blowing out the fire, so that the air then dispersed around the room. But what is most sacred is the sipa. This hole in the ground represented dead spirits who could then come and communicate with the living. And that's how they believed that they could communicate with the dead, was through the sipa, and they would have their dances and their sacred ceremonies in here and communicate with the dead and offer their prayers. And the fires that they burned here, that were also burned in teepees of the Indians that lived on the land, were prayers being ascended to Father Sky. The hunters of the cliff dwellers. Same thing. If the hunter violated the rituals, the guardian spirit of the animal would take revenge by causing the hunter misfortune or allowing the game to become scarce. Pueblo and cliff dwellers had 250 different gods, and each of these gods could be portrayed in what was called a kachina doll. And these kachina dolls, this is how they believed the image of the god to look, and these dolls were created to help the children understand who the gods were, what they looked like, and who it was that they were worshiping as they were learning their religion. Today we just think, oh, kachina doll, I want a kachina doll, whoopee, okay. Oh, it's very sacred to the Pueblo and the cliff dwellers. That's a tradition that's carried on today for us white folk to see. All right. The Maori had some unique beliefs. They believed that there were various sacred trees, rocks, logs, outcroppings of land that had their own powers and spirits. And what is interesting is they believed that you could put a curse on those if the rock or the tree or whatever heard the cursing. And so if there was a sacred stream and there was a particular god that protected the stream, they would take the rock that was believed to be the spiritual essence of the stream and hide it somewhere. So if somebody came by to the stream to curse it, to dry it up, the rock that controlled the stream wouldn't hear the cursing, and so the cursing couldn't take effect. Or a waterfall. They would hide the rock within the waterfall, so the person who's trying to yell the cursing, the rock couldn't hear it because the waterfall was making too much noise. Interesting traditions that the Maori have. In the Book of Mormon, we learn about Hagoth, who took several settlers, did it twice, went off into the Western Sea. We didn't hear from him ever again. Okay? The belief is that Hagoth either traveled up north to help settle Mexico, North America, or went out in the Pacific to settle the islands. We have two comments that I wanted to share with you. One by President David O. McKay when he dedicated the New Zealand Temple. He said, "We express gratitude that to these fertile islands thou didst guide the descendants of Father Lehi and hast enabled them to prosper, to develop, and to become associated in history with leading and influential nations among mankind." And Joseph F. Smith said, he was a missionary in the Hawaiian Islands, so they were a very special place for him. "Away off in the Pacific Ocean are various groups of islands, from the Sandwich Islands," which was the Hawaiian Islands before, "down to Tahiti, Samoa, Tonga, and New Zealand. Among them are thousands of good people, dark-skinned, but blood of Israel. When you carry the gospel to them, they receive it with open hearts." So we know that the blood of Israel is in the Pacific Islands. Did they come from Hagoth? Why not? That may not be the only source by which they came from, but you certainly can't discount Hagoth and his story of them traveling off. The Aztecs. These guys had some interesting traditions. They were also very bloody people, kind of like the Mayan. Okay, so that tradition, I'm not going to go through all that again. Aztec religion was one of gaining favor with the gods. The individual worshipers were not striving for spiritual perfection or personal salvation, but was trying to influence the natural forces so that they worked in his favor or for the good of the community as a whole. That was the purpose of the religion. Every day was relating to the gods. Okay, it's not like you and I have in our religion where we're trying to better ourselves and improve ourselves and become more like God. They try to just make gods happy. But these guys had some interesting traditions, superstitions, if you will. I don't know how many of you are superstitious, but if you look at it logically, they're rather silly, dumb things that we believe in that are superstitious. You know, don't have a 13th floor in a building and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, these guys I thought were rather funny. When a child lost one of his baby teeth, the mother dropped the tooth in a mouse hole. For without this precaution, the second tooth would not grow. They thought, for example, that a girl who ate her meal standing up would be married a long way from home. That a man who accidentally kicked one of the hearthstones, be around the fireplace, would get numb feet on the battlefield and would be unable to fight or run away. That anybody who leaned against a square pillar would grow up to be a liar. And that a woman who ate a tamale, which had stuck to the side of a pot, would not be able to bear children. Some interesting tidbits there on the Aztec. You starve steady. Or keep stirring the tamales so they don't stick to the side of the pot. The Inca. These guys are fascinating. 15,000 miles worth of roadway. Kind of like the Romans that they built for various reasons. One of them obviously was to be able to move the military from one part of the empire to another. That's I don't know if you ever looked at Peru, but that's a long country, okay? And they didn't have cars and tanks and all that kind of stuff to get around. It was just by men, and it's a very mountainous region, and so they would build these roadways. Also, because the people were on the coastline and up in the mountains, and over here was the forest, they would have paths into the forest, and so there would be hunters that would go in and hunt game, and then they could transfer that game, that meat, to the people that lived along the shoreline. You had people who fished in the sea and could take their sea catches and feed it on to the people that were over here for them to have fresh fish and various other ocean animals to be able to eat. Also, the emperor, the Inca, could get messages from one part of the empire to another. This, I thought, was quite interesting. The roadways were used for communication purposes with the capital, which was Cuzco, right about here in the center. Okay, every 1 or 2 miles along the road, there were little huts where runners were stationed. When a runner was given a message, he ran as fast as he could to the next post. The next runner would be waiting for him and would set off at top speed as soon as the message had been passed along. In this way, they could issue orders, travel news, or whatever. They could cover 200 miles in a day. All along the road, about every 12 miles, were what we would call way stations. These provided places where sleep and food and blankets and other supplies could be had as various travelers were using the roadway moving from one part of the country to another. It reminds me of the old Pony Express days. Okay. So anyway, these Native Americans were not stupid. They had a lot of the wisdom already. He Walked the Americas was the name of the book, and the author's name is L, just the initial L, Taylor Hansen. It's kind of a hard book to find now. Sun, S-O-N.
Is that where you can publish?
I can't publish it yet. It's not been 75 years for me to be able to publish it, unless I can get permission from the publishing company who has the copyright. All throughout this mountainous area of Peru, you've got these chasms and river gorges and all this. This river down here is 118 feet below this bridge. This is the longest bridge in Peru, at 220 feet long, all made with fibers from plants. They would twist and bind them together, and they would move troops, food, walk, carry on, and move across all these things. Fascinating. They would upkeep these all the time. There would be people that would be assigned to maintain the bridge to make sure the bridge was safe and intact at all times. You find that all over Peru. Wonderful culture. Just wonderful stuff. Okay. The Arapaho. One of the books I published has and it's already been sold, so it's... It's called A String of Pearls. An LDS missionary described what it was like to create leather by the Arapaho. It takes from 2 to 3 days to dress a robe. And this comes from the journals from the missionaries as they would be venturing out or coming back home and run across the Native Americans. And this is from Arapaho tribe. In the first place, they scraped it on the flesh side until it became thin. Then they soaked some of the buffalo's brains in water and put this liquor on the flesh side until it will not retain any more. The brain of an animal is sufficient to dress its skin or robe, and sometimes more. After the robe or skin has become well soaked through with the brain liquor, it is stretched tight upon sticks with the skin side to the sun if the weather is fine, and if cloudy, a fire is made to dry it. While the drying process is going on, the party dressing it rubs it on the flesh side with a piece of sandstone about the size of a brick. This is continued until it is perfectly dry and soft. All robes and skins are dressed in this manner except small skins, which are rubbed with the hands. That's how they would make their leather. It smelled funky, yes. The Pawnee, another LDS missionary in the same book, talked about how they hunted for fish. Try this, you fishermen. When traveling near a river, the young braves, who were very expert with the bow and arrow, would frequently be seen shooting fish. I have often seen them standing in the water, shooting fish as they passed by them. I knew one Indian to kill from 4 to 17 good-sized fish in 2 hours. This was, to me, very interesting sport. The Indian's method of cooking fish is very different to ours. After making a good wood fire and getting a quantity of hot ashes, they wrap the fish in clean, wet grass. Put it under the hot ashes, add more wood to the fire, and let it remain until the fish is cooked. This takes from 1 to 2 hours, according to size. This may appear a very strange way of cooking to my readers, but it proved to me a very good one, and the fish is much sweeter, I think, than when fried in lard or butter, according to our custom. So you might want to try that sometime. The Teton Sioux had a tradition of going out on a vision quest, where the young people, when they become becoming into adolescence, it was time for them to go and identify themselves in life. And so they would go off into the desert. First, they would fast for 4 days, and then they would go off into the desert and obtain their vision. And it was purposely a vision quest. They were seeking their guardian spirit, who would take care of them and protect them and teach them throughout the rest of their life. And the hope was that they could have that spirit manifest itself to them during their vision quest. And that spirit would then provide them what their death song would be, what their things that they could sing to protect them would be, would also help them identify what their sacred omelets would be, their charms, there we go, whether it be a feather, a rock, or whatever it would be. And of course, they would keep these in their pouches, and they would often sew these into their teepee linings and into their clothing linings, these images. It was sacred to them throughout the rest of their life. And they would go on these vision quests. And then when they would come back to camp, now they were an adult because they'd had their vision quest manifested, and they would carry on with their life and receive their direction. Today, what it is called, the American Indian Movement, that is endeavoring to try and reestablish the traditions of the Native Americans and help us white people gain an appreciation for them and allow the Native Americans an opportunity to express their traditions. One of the things that offends them immensely is professional baseball and football and hockey teams having as part of their mascot something that is of Native American. And so they have been pressing colleges and universities and pro teams to remove any reference of a Native American and change their mascot. Okay? There's still a few teams that haven't done that. They are not in favor of Columbus Day. For obvious reasons, it destroyed their culture and their society. So you and I need to appreciate their point of view when it comes to that, and just don't ignore it. Oh, Columbus game, wow! For them, it ruined their life. And so they see it a day of bondage. Now, I mentioned the Nez Perce at the beginning. This gentleman's name is Chief Joseph. And a book was written about him called I Will Fight No More Forever. And there's a movie made. Chief Joseph led his people on a 1,700-mile race to Canada and lost 30 miles from the border in an effort to try and remain free. In 1877, General Howard was in pursuit of Chief Joseph to put them all under the reservation. And finally, Chief Joseph could go no longer. And here's what he had to say. If I get emotional, I'm sorry. Tell General Howard I know his heart. What he told me before, I have in my heart. I am tired of fighting. Our chiefs are killed. Looking Glass is dead. Tuhohosuti is dead. The old men are all dead. It is the young men who say yes or no. He who led on the young men is dead. It is cold, and we have no blankets. The little children are freezing to death. My people, some of them, have run away to the hills and have no blankets, no food. No one knows where they are, perhaps freezing to death. I want to have time to look for my children and see how many of them I can find. Maybe I shall find them among the dead. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. Now, I don't want to leave this on a negative note. The prophecy in the Book of Mormon states, and it came to pass that I beheld the Spirit of God, that it wrought upon other Gentiles, and they went forth out of captivity upon the many waters. And it came to pass that I beheld many multitudes of the Gentiles upon the land of promise. And I beheld the wrath of God, that it was upon the seed of my brethren, and they were scattered before the Gentiles and were smitten. But the promise. And thank goodness for our missionary efforts today. For behold, the promises which we have obtained are promises unto us according to the flesh. Wherefore, as it has been shown unto me that many of our children shall perish in the flesh because of unbelief, nevertheless, God will be merciful unto many, and our children shall be restored, that they may come to that which that will give them the true knowledge of their Redeemer. That's the message of the Book of Mormon. And that's why the brethren plead and beg for us to get the word out, to raise our sons and daughters in an effort to share the message of the gospel to these poor people who have been punished for their wickedness, but have been promised a restoration to the knowledge of the truth. We as homeschoolers have a unique opportunity because they're not going to get it in a public school or even in a private school, but we have that opportunity as homeschoolers to teach our children the truth, to help them gain some respect of these particular people if they get to go to the Native Americans, and share with the world this knowledge of the gospel. And of course, these promises are to everyone. My son just got over to Slovenia, and we're excited to have him over. He had to wait 2 months for his visa, so he was in Georgia for 2 months. But the opportunity is there, and we get to have that kind of an effect upon our children, to teach them truth, help them understand the principles of truth, whether it's in math, science, or history, or the gospel, and then take that knowledge and carry it out and become whatever the Lord has foreordained them to do in their mission here in life. And you are the parents of those children, and you get to do that as homeschoolers. Don't lose the sight of why you're homeschooling. It's not just to teach your kids math and science, although that is important. It is to teach them how they can stand on their own, obey and follow the principles of truth and right, and carry on their mission, whatever they were foreordained to do. That, I think, is a wonderful opportunity that we have. And if we are faithful and humble and prayerful, it'll come to pass. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.